This is the beginning of class 9.
Sasi bhagi jushinne tasham viravin shinyande yamadhi samye shindu mitte huwahi jogunanda shimla
you're not thinking.
So you're there just by intellectual.
You're perceiving it directly, raw pure awareness of
through intellect.
No, I mean talking about number two.
Yeah, I was talking about number one.
You can perceive it. You are perceiving it right now.
But it's
in
it's
a very rough way.
In two different ways.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the first one is to perceive. You can perceive any object two ways, actually. You can perceive it with logic, reasoning, thinking, or you can perceive it directly. Every object can be perceived both ways. There's certain objects that you and I, if you are who you seem to be, can't be perceived. We can't perceive directly. For example, you and I can't perceive emptiness directly if we are in a room like this and talking to each other. It's impossible. And then there's other kind of objects that we can see colors and shapes. That we can see directly. And then there's objects which we have to use reasoning. Like you heard the phone ring. It only rang twice. It probably means that somebody picked it up. And if in your mind, if you saw somebody pick it up, you just used reasoning to perceive someone picking it up. You actually saw someone picking it up in your mind with reasoning. Could have been wrong, right? Could be that the person just hung up after 2 weeks. Now you hear someone talking. So with all your reasoning, with logic, you assume that someone picked up the phone. You can't see it. So you see it with logic, with reasoning. That's one way. Right now we can only see emptiness that way. But it's valid. It's a real seeing. But seeing it directly is what gets you out of this kind of korwa, this kind of life, suffering.
What's the relationship to the form raya, the formless raya?
We'll study it in the Abhidharma.
Rayams.
Abhidharma, third chapter.
Yeah.
We'll study it. Very interesting. And it's too long. There's three realms. We live in the desire realm. It's the lowest realm. And the first Dalai Lama says it's because our desire for food and sex keeps us here. And then that's why they call it the desire realm. Mainly our interests are centered around that kind of objects. And then in the form realm, they still have a physical body, but it's a very different kind of body. And they have very pure mental, they have a very pleasant mental state there. And that's because they meditated in this life, on the life before they meditated on pleasant ideas that didn't have, they weren't religious necessarily.
But is the pure lens?
No. There are two kinds of pure lens. One is a worldly pure lens and one is an ultimate pure lens. And yeah, they are worldly pure lens. Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. Okay. So, Denpa Ni means, you've heard maybe the two truths, okay? Denpa means truth, Ni means two. Dhamma means truth, Ni means two. These are what you have to perceive to see emptiness. The first one is a preliminary to seeing emptiness, and the second one is really seeing emptiness. Okay? Dhamma, the word means truth. What does it mean to you, like friend? Dhamma. Truth. What does the word truth mean to you?
Well, I know there's conventional and ultimate.
Yeah, but forget that. If I just said, what does truth mean? If I'm a foreigner, and I say, what is truth?
But to me, it's the essence of something. What it,
yeah?
I guess that.
It's
something that you know to be absolutely so.
Yeah. And it's opposed to what? Truth is opposed to what?
As opposed to inaccurate.
False.
Yeah.
False.
Yeah.
True and false. I mean, they said all the time, true and false. Okay? The word Dhamma, that does mean truth, it's translated as truth, doesn't mean true or false. Okay? It doesn't mean true or false. It's not the truth in true or false. And a lot of people, when they read a book on Buddhism and they hear about the two truths, if you're like me, I got very confused. Because the truth is a fact, right? The truth is like the sky is blue. And New York is a big city. And those are truth. But New York itself is not a truth. A truth is a fact about New York. New York is not a truth. The idea is here that you have to understand that the word truth is not meant to refer to something true. Truth here is a division of reality. You should call it the two realities.
So the durability or truth is something that lasts forever?
Not like that. No. Truth is a misnomer here. Okay, and in the monastery, when you get to this subject, and you will, when we debate it, the first debate is, what are you dividing when you come up with two truths? What are you dividing? Are you dividing truth, or are you dividing existence? And the and in the monastery, when you get to this subject, and you will, when we debate it, the first debate is, what are you dividing when you come up with two truths? What are you dividing? Are you dividing truth, or are you dividing existence? And the second answer is true. You are not dividing truth into two truths. You're dividing everything in the universe into this thing or this thing. So really, the two truths are not divisions of truth. They are divisions of existence. And each of the two truths refers to the actual things. This is truth number one. That lamp is truth number one, meaning reality number one. The table is reality number one. My mind is reality number one. My body, myself, Michael, is reality number one. So reality means object. Okay, truth here means object. It doesn't mean something true. That's the point. And people who read Buddhist books will always get confused. I mean, I don't think if you talk to 100 people who've read about the two truths, I don't know if any of them understand that truth doesn't mean true thing. It just means one of the two realities. Two kinds of reality. Yep.
Mode of existence.
Yep.
Two modes of existence.
Actually, existence itself, see? Reality itself.
The two modes that existence has, or
existence? Look into it.
Reality itself.
Like, you can divide all things in the world into permanent and impermanent. That's one way to do it. We do that. Permanent and impermanent. There's about a trillion impermanent things, and there's only 3 or 4 permanent things. Okay. Or you can divide them into pure or impure. All changing things are impure, except for Dharma. Okay. Like that. You can divide them that way. And you can divide them into the two truths. Those things which are truth number one, and those things which are truth number two, meaning reality number one and reality number two. That's the only thing. Be aware of that. It's very tricky. And most people never get that far.
Is the analogy with the dream? I mean, meaning the living life is a dream, so...
We're coming. It's coming right now.
Is Yamdak Vetao, is that correct view of emptiness, or just view of emptiness?
It's correct view, and it doesn't have to be of emptiness. For example, you have correct view about karma. But in this case, it refers to... But I would say, no, it doesn't. No, it refers to karma also. Even in this case. It always has to refer to emptiness also. To understanding it, the way things exist.
Including everything in that subheading.
Yeah. Okay, here's truth number one. Say, Gunzel.
Gunzel.
Demba.
Gunzel.
Gunzel.
Demba.
Gunzel. Demba.
Gunzel. Demba.
Gunzel. Demba.
Gunzel. Demba.
Okay. Gunzel Denpa is what is mostly usually translated as conventional reality, conventional truth, relative truth. I don't like any of those words. No, just so you know, when you read a book, you know the word Gunzel is very clear, and it means bogus, deceptive. I prefer deceptive.
You did this translation, right?
Ah, yeah.
Conventional, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, he doesn't.
For the lowest
conventional is an is a synonym for Gunzel, but it's not Gunzel. And when you get to it as a synonym for Gunzel, you're in trouble if you use it for Gunzel, you see? But that's another story. Gunzel means deceptive. Gunzel means bogus. I didn't invent the bogus word. Somebody in the last class came up with it. It's actually very good. Call it deceptive truth. Deceptive truth. I'm going to debate you about it. We'll go
through. Just say, have a would be truth.
You can say that too.
Yeah,
would be. So, Kylie, let's do a debate, right? Okay. I want to debate in the next class. I'll start debating with you guys in the next class. We couldn't do it now because we're running late all the time anyway. Okay, close up demo. Yeah. Did you touch your chance? How about this one? Let's debate this.
Okay.
Okay, which means you can't tell me what you are dividing when you divide something into the two truths. What are you dividing when you get the two truths?
Perception.
That's in the monastery and say, come on. perception. Are you telling me perception is, this is a confirmation, I say. Are you telling me perception is the division of two truths? Perception is what you're dividing when you get the two truths? When you get the two realities?
Well, there's two kinds of perceptions of
that. You're only allowed to say yes or no.
Oh.
Is perception what you are dividing when you get two truths? Truths, please.
Perception is what you have when you have either of the two truths.
I didn't ask you what you had. I asked you what are you dividing when you get the two truths. Sure.
Perception.
Okay. So really the two truths is the two perceptions.
Yes.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So each truth is a perception.
Yes.
Truth number two. Let's take truth number two. Perception yimaha. Is it a perception? Yimaha. Lata, come on, let's go. They would be hitting you in the head by now. No. Is truth number two a perception? Right. According to you?
Yeah, no, I guess not. It's just always there.
Ha!
It's real.
So, aren't you ashamed of yourself? Okay, sure. Now, can you come up with a better thing to divide to get the two truths, please? Sure. What are you dividing when you get two truths?
I don't think you can divide truth. So all we can talk about is two different ways of perceiving it.
How about the way that?
So you say truth number two is a perception. Are you dividing kinds of perceptions when you get the two truths?
I think that there's one truth that's perceived two ways.
Oh, good. So, Yeshi definitely. You're telling me that what you're dividing is the truth, and it's divided into two types, depending on how you see them.
No, I don't think you can divide the truth.
What are you dividing? I mean, you got a heading of. Anytime you have two of some of the same thing, you're dividing something. I mean, like cars into Chevrolet and Ford, right? All right, we got truth number one is here. Truth number two is here. What are you dividing? Yeshi Karisha. Yeshi Karisha.
Well, I think it's called the two truths, but to me it means the one truth perceived two ways.
Good. Okay. Yeah. So it's.
So you're not dividing. You're dividing. You talked about two different perceptions of the one thing.
What are you? Then you're dividing one thing, right, into two.
You're dividing. I think you're dividing perceptions of one thing into two perceptions. That's what I'm saying.
When you when you say there's two kinds of people, what are you dividing?
People.
You are dividing
people. Okay. When you say there's two kinds of cars, what are you dividing?
Cars.
Okay. When you're dividing two truths, what are you dividing?
All truth.
Truth. Right. Truth. Then in the monastery they'll say, "Kunzab demba chujin." If you say that what you are dividing when you get two truths is the truth, okay? Then kunzab demba chujin, demba yimaha. Are you telling me it's truth? Are you telling me it's true?
The original thing or the division?
No, now I'm talking about division number one. According to you, now if you filled in this thing, you said this is truth.
It's a kind of truth.
Right. No, that's all I want.
Yeah, if it came from the original truth, it has
to
be. Right,
it's one
of
the two divisions of truth. Yimaha.
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yimaha, okay? You agree, right? Yes. So, Kunzo Demba Chirichin. Let's talk about Kunzo Demba. Truth Yimaha. Are you telling me it's truth? It's a kind of truth?
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to say right. Right. Then I say, Kunzo my Yimaha. It's always a setup. You don't know. I mean, it's a setup in front of 1,000 monks and set you up. And then they smear you, you know?
Okay.
Kunzo means fake. Kunzo means fake.
Then how does it come from the whole truth?
So, fake truth. Yata. Are you telling me that fake is true? That fakes are true?
It couldn't have come from truth if it weren't true.
Right. So this can't be truth, because this is fake. This is deceptive reality.
Or else that's not deceptive.
But still,
no, that's what the word means, and it is that.
Maybe it's deceptive
reality. No, this is correct.
But still,
it's
true.
So that's not true.
No, it's not true. Fake things are not true. That's the definition of false.
But
a movie is not real. Is a movie real? I mean, it is a real movie. But is it, I mean, when you tell somebody in a movie, does the guy really die except for Bruce Lee's son? No, it's fake.
But then
it's made up, right?
But then you deny your conventional reality, and then you are in trouble.
We'll get there.
See, but you're
what I'm saying is that I'm trying to say why the translation relative truth or conventional truth is wrong. It's not correct. Because otherwise that debate, which is the first debate in the two truths, and you'll get there, that's the first debate. They say, of course, these are not divisions of truth. They are divisions of existence.
Aren't you presupposing that
all things?
Aren't you presupposing that subdivision one is completely accurate and not?
Oh, they are accurate. Truth. I mean, Chandrakirti says it in the text. There's only two kinds of stuff: either Kunzabdhamma or the other. So these are divisions of existing things. And half the existing things in the world are deceptive.
So really you have to prove that those are the only two possible divisions to be able to
apply
to this principle.
Yeah, they are. But they are not divisions of truth. They are divisions of reality. Half of the objects in the world are deceptive. What does deceptive mean? What does it mean to be fake?
It's forgery.
Yeah, it looks one way, but it's really something different. And that's exactly the definition of Kunzabdhamma.
Are you saying that objectively some are real, or are you saying that sentient beings perceive them a certain way and
Buddhas
perceive them the other way?
We're getting there. Okay. Kunzabdhamma means those objects in the world which to us, okay, that's what you and Mr. Kali wrote, and it's true, you have to say that, which to normal people look different than the way they really are. They fake you out. They deceive you. Okay. They seem to be one way, but they are really a different way. And that's what Kunzabdhamma means.
An incorrect perception.
No. That object, which to a certain state of mind, appears different than it really is.
It is perceived differently than the way it really is.
To certain people.
Right.
But it is not the perception. Perception is mental event. This could be a chair, this could be a city, this could be an elephant. Yeah, okay.
All right? Well, it can't.
He's
a chair and elephant
or
city is a
perception.
Oh, sure, sure.
Itself.
What makes it that way is a different question. But its nature is that to the mind of a normal person, it seems different than it is.
And are you saying its nature is not dependent on our quality of perception?
Oh, it is. That's what I just said. To a normal person, it looks one way, but it's really a different way. The way it looks and the way it is doesn't fit.
Yeah.
In Tibetan you say, Nesa da nasa mitumbe yubeyeja. The way it is and the way it seems to be are different. And that's Kunzabdhamma. And that's why I prefer the translation deceptive truth. Because you've got to get that debate. That debate is in the monastery, the first debate you ever do. You have to say, truth which lies. Truth which lies.
There are things which two sentient beings look a certain way and are in fact that way. So there's another category of things.
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Can you do three or four on that?
I'm glad you asked.
But in that case, isn't deceptive truth the misuse of the word truth then?
The word is a misnomer. Military intelligence. I mean, what was the other one? What do you call those things?
Jumbo shrimp.
Yeah, jumbo shrimp. It's a misnomer. I want you to reach this idea, what you just said. Fake reality. Lying truth. Truth which lies. That's what it is. That's why Gemma here doesn't refer to truth. It refers to reality.
So why don't you call it would-be truth? I think
that's
an honest way of putting it.
Would-be Kunzo,
truth,
by the way,
means
Kunzo,
not the truth. It's not perceptive or otherwise.
Kunzo means completely. Zot means fake. Okay, it's the word that's used, for example, for what the worst lying you can do. The worst sin of lying you can do is to claim that you have certain spiritual realizations that you don't have. When you take your five vows for your lifetime, which you all should think about today, and they say you can't lie anymore, this is the main line that you've achieved some kind of level that you haven't. That's sotsu. It's the same root. So it means to lie, to be fake. So obviously, truth can't lie. So this doesn't mean truth. It means reality. That kind of reality, that division of reality.
Deceptive reality.
I love that.
That's much better than deceptive truth.
Deceptive perception.
No, but you have to say truth to catch the oxymoron, you see. Yeah. It is an oxymoron, even in Tibetan, even in Sanskrit. It's a contradiction of terms. And it was supposed to be. They want you to fight about it, worry about it, and then you come up and say, well, it can't be true. Well, you're right, it's not true, it's reality.
Is perception also accurate there? No. Deceptive perception?
No.
It's not.
It's the object, not the perceiver.
But you're saying that there is something that's inherently which is inherently able to be perceived differently by Buddhists and non-Buddhists, and there's another class of objects which have some kind of inherent quality which allows them to be perceived the same.
Who said inherent?
Well, when you say...
I never said it.
You inferred.
I didn't even infer.
Maybe you heard that. If there's some self-existent object that the
perceiver
is always
changing. But if it's
not
something that's dependent on perception, then it has to have an inherent quality of its own.
We'll get there.
Right.
We'll get there. It's a very interesting... don't worry. We're going to debate it all tonight. We only have two classes to cover about 30,000 pages.
Step number two?
Yeah. This is number two.
So then would you say deceptive object there? Or that's not accurate either.
You could say that.
Deceptive object.
Yeah, but also, your mind as a subject is also the number one involved.
Yeah.
Considered as an object. The subject is considered as an object. Any sin. Object is a synonym in Buddhism for reality. You?
Say that again?
The object is a synonym for reality. But that you don't have to worry about that. You'll get that in course number three. Say, Jindam.
Dhamma.
Ultimate truth. Dhamma means ultimate. Dhamma means truth. It is not, oh, life is suffering. That is the ultimate truth. That's not what it means. What does it mean? That's one.
Reality as a Buddha
perceives. Ultimate reality. Oh, reality as a Buddha perceives. Himata. Are you telling me that this is reality as a Buddha sees it? Himata. How about deceptive reality, which is Buddha perceives? Are you telling me it's ultimate reality? Let's talk about the deceptive reality which is Buddha perceives. Are you telling me it's ultimate reality? Because it's reality as a Buddha sees it.
He sees it as deceptive.
Huh?
He sees it as deceptive because he sees ultimate reality
at the
same time.
Huh?
Yes.
He perceives it as perception?
As deceptive.
Yes. Does he perceive ultimate reality when he sees it?
Yes.
Deceptive reality?
Yes.
When he understands it's deceptive, that's
so,
what you're saying.
Is the way it appears and the way it really is match or not? Does the way it appears and the way it really is match or not?
No.
What?
It's
Himata.
Yes.
Himata. So you're telling me it's what he perceives is deceptive reality and not ultimate reality.
He perceives both simultaneously.
So are the way they appear and the way they really are, do they match or not?
They don't match, and only one can perceive that.
Are you telling me then that ultimate reality, the way it seems and the way it really is, are completely the same? not the same, sorry. You tell me they're not the same?
No, not the same.
Oh, my ima, huh? Not the same?
Not the same.
Kadam Dhamma Chujim. Let's talk about ultimate reality. Nasa da Nesa Tupu Mayima. Are you telling me the way they appear and the way they are, they don't match?
It doesn't match.
No, Dhamma. Then it's not ultimate reality. Because that's the definition of ultimate reality.
What's the definition of ultimate reality?
It's the way it appears and the way it really is are the same.
The Dhamma Sutra, they say that samsara and nirvana are the same.
That's the definition?
Well, it's the description. It's not the technical. Sure. It's the reality which is the way it seems. And the other one is the reality which is not the way it seems.
So then isn't number one part of number two then?
What?
Because if two is ultimate reality and includes deceptive reality.
No, no. Ultimate reality, the way it appears to you and the way it really is, match. And deceptive reality, the way it seems to be and the way it really is, don't match.
It sounded like what you were saying was, does deceptive reality and ultimately reality match?
That's not at all. No,
like
that's not what
saying.
I meant. No.
So that's what I
meant. No, I didn't mean that.
So is what you're saying then is that ultimate reality is the perception of reality that is correct with the way it really is?
Reality is not a perception. The perception of reality is one tiny little object in that giant bag. Perceptions are mental events.
So then the first one is reality that doesn't perceive the way it really is?
The reality which, to a normal person's mind, seems one way, but is really a different way.
But can that be anything other than the second? That same reality that you're talking about?
Sure, yeah.
Everything in this room is reality number one. That you can see right now.
It's not reality number two being perceived in a certain way.
No, not at all.
And it has no reality number two.
It
has no relationship to
all reality. Objects have false realities. All objects possess false realities. But all objects are not false realities. There's a difference between having a book and being a book, right? In Tibetan, there's two different words, verbs, yin and yun. You can say, I have a book, it doesn't mean I am a book. All objects in the world have their nature, their deceptive nature, and all, even emptiness, has a deceptive nature. And all objects in the world have their own emptiness, which is truth number two. It's a really reality. Every object in the world has its own emptiness. How many kinds of emptiness are there?
There's only one.
As many as there are things in the universe, there's that many emptiness. Each object has its own emptiness.
When we were talking about the five heaps that are contaminated, that's as far as the samsara, because we don't perceive correctly, it seems that the implication of having a misconception of our reality is on us, is on the perceivers.
No, the objects.
The ones that you clean up.
No, the objects themselves have a quality. Yeah, it's interdependent, right? They have a quality of appearing one way to our state of mind.
So samsara is.
You want to say, is it the object's fault or our fault?
So samsara is both in the five heaps that are contaminated and in the outside reality.
It's a, we'll get there.
Both.
This is the key to the door to liberation.
So Michael, is that any different, ultimate realities? When you finally do perceive ultimate reality, I assume the one you are perceiving is the ultimate reality of yourself.
We'll get
rather
there.
Than the ultimate reality of the lamp over there?
Okay.
We'll get there.
Okay, I'm confused.
Can you repeat
take that?
I was going to go on to the next Sunday. I thought you already realized. You guys can put shit into in 1 week.
Oh, that's easy. That's fast.
Let's play it again. 7:30.
False reality?
Yes, we do. All objects.
You said the
also have an emptiness. Each object in the universe has two truths.
All objects have to this false reality, but and
empty.
All objects have empty.
No, not but. To possess the second reality is to possess emptiness, because the second reality, ultimate truth, ultimate reality, is another word for emptiness. Ultimate, the only kind of ultimate reality is emptiness. They are synonyms.
So then what about...
No, the word ultimate, Dhyan Dhamma and emptiness are the same.
So all objects have both truths,
yes.
So all objects have their own emptiness.
No, I didn't say that. That isn't how I said it. What I said
was... Say the whole thing again.
I'll say it again. Every object in the universe possesses both truths. Every object in the universe has both modes of reality.
So when you're...
Every object in the universe has both reality, but
they are not
both realities. What I mean to say is, Laura possesses emptiness, but she is not emptiness. Emptiness is a negative eternal thing. We wish she was a positive eternal thing. Actually, she's a positive un-eternal thing. She's going to die, probably, unless she does some good karma. So, that's not... what I mean to say is, you can have emptiness and not be emptiness. John Stillwell has emptiness. But that doesn't mean to say he is emptiness. If you were emptiness, you would be... Well, for one thing, we couldn't see you.
What is that distinction? Why is that different? Why is it
we'll talk about it.
It's like to say that a cell is black, but it's not the black hole.
Just what I said. I have a pen. That doesn't mean Michael has a pen, but Michael is not the pen. You have emptiness, but you are not the emptiness.
So
emptiness is sitting on you. Every object shares the quality of being empty. Every object in the universe is empty. But it's not true to say every object in the world is emptiness.
Oh, well, there's that.
You're here. You're far behind, right?
So, you don't mean to... I mean, you better be careful. The way you're explaining it, it sounds like two different things. Make yourself clear. Are you talking about two different things, or are you talking about two different sides of the same thing, or two different facets of the same thing?
No, two different...
Two different things.
When you say optic has two...
Truths.
Two truths mean number one and number two.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Why do I have the first truth? Why does Michael have the first truth? Why do I have deceptive truth? Because to you, it seems that I exist outside of your mind. When you look at Michael, you think, I'm out here and you're over there, and I'm not just something in your mind. To put it easily.
Right.
That's the first truth. I'm deceiving you. I'm tricking you. I look like I'm out here. But really, I'm just an object in your mind. That's an
and
easy
that's
way...
Like you. That's the mind.
That's an easy way to explain the first one. Okay. An easy way to explain the second one is... Michael is empty because he's not something in your mind.
Put
it different. I'll put it easier. Michael, it is a double negative. Emptiness is a double negative. But I'll put it a little bit easier. Michael is empty because he's not what you thought. He's not what you thought. Why is Michael deceptive truth? Why does Michael have deceptive truth? Michael seems to be outside of your mind, but Michael is not outside. That is my deceptive truth. I have that deceptive truth. In fact, I am deceptive reality.
And your emptiness is what?
My emptiness is I'm not the way you thought I was.
What's the other thing you said about that?
Well, I didn't want to confuse that. I'm not what you thought.
So how come you...
That's my emptiness.
How can I tell that the deceptive truth of Michael is something that you have as opposed to something that is that in the way I see it.
Yeah. Because you don't even understand either truth about me. Right now, you don't understand either one.
No.
Okay? You don't even see my deceptive reality, much less my emptiness. When you perceive my ultimate reality, you will become an Arya. You perceive directly. But right now, you don't even understand how I exist in a deceptive way. You don't understand it.
I don't even know.
You, when you perceive that, you're already on step number two. You're already on very high space. So you don't even know that I'm deceptive. You're in this limbo where you don't perceive either truth.
That's the
and there's a big debate in the monastery. Okay? So is it true that you, let's say you are who you seem to be, okay? Okay? I don't know if you're not a Buddha, okay? So that's why I have to say that. Let's assume you are just a plain old student in Islam. Okay. Is it true that you do not perceive deceptive reality? I just said that, right?
Yeah.
We're not even, forgive it, emptiness, which is perceiving truth number two. We can't even see truth number one. Yamata.
Right.
Huh? You don't perceive yellow?
I perceive it, but it's deceptive.
Then you have perceived truth number one? Are you on a very high stage, like stage number two?
No, it's really up here.
Yes or no? Have you perceived the first reality?
No, I don't feel it.
Are you telling me you have not perceived the first reality?
Yes.
Serpo Matata. You don't see the yellow? What's the matter with you? Serpo Matata. Oh, no one's talking about Serpo Matata.
No, you
see the yellow or not?
Yes.
Yes. Kunzo Tata. Can you perceive deceptive reality? Because it seems to be yellow out here, but it's really just yellow in your mind. Kunzo Tata. So you do perceive deceptive reality.
I perceive the yellow.
I didn't ask that.
How do I know it's deceptive?
Do you perceive
the I don't know it's deceptive unless I know what the ultimate truth is of it.
Oh, I'll just tell you. It exists in your mind and not up here. Good luck out there.
I'm just going to take your word for it.
No, the point is this. I mean, think about it. Listen, okay, carefully. This is Queen of Denver. This yellow color is deceptive reality. It is a deceptive reality. One example of deceptive reality. And she does see the yellow. But she answered correctly, that doesn't mean I have perceived deceptive reality as deceptive reality. See, that's in the monastery, you'd have to say that. I did perceive deceptive reality. I didn't perceive deceptive reality as deceptive reality.
How can you make that distinction?
Because in order to see deceptive reality, it's deceptive reality. You have to realize
very high, to
be able
very
to
high
see the other kind of reality.
Very, no,
right?
No,
no.
So it comes before that.
So then you're making two distinctions.
Well, at least intellectually.
Intellectually, for sure.
So you're making two divisions of separate reality, two kinds of separate reality. That's what you're saying.
Of deceptive reality?
Yeah.
Yeah. Ways of perceiving.
In a way, there's the one that you are seeing deceptive reality all the time.
Yeah.
But you don't know it's deceptive reality.
Right.
All your eyes are. In fact, that's the only reality you've ever seen. If you are who you seem to be.
Well, but you are in that illusion if you attribute to yourself a reality.
The way it really is.
If you start perceiving that it's
reality.
Your own reality,
reality.
It's fake, then you don't attribute to the outside.
If I hit you on the head, it's not reality. Come on. No, you have to be careful. Look at this. Okay. Stand up.
So, Michael, going back to the two truths and the meaning of the word truth.
Yeah.
If you're saying that this is the way in which reality exists, right, or the two ways in which reality exists, mm-hmm. isn't that essentially saying here's the truth about the way in which reality
exists? It is
exists?
In a sense. It is in a sense. But what I'm trying to say is this comes up down. Yeah. The shirt is comes up down. And it's hard in the monastery. I mean, if someone doesn't explain to you clearly, you can go for like 6 months and not catch it. This is conceptual. It's not true. You know what I mean? It's not a fact.
Yeah.
It's not a truth. It's not a statement. This is this.
Yeah.
It's an object. And you are seeing Quinto Tempo all the time.
It's a perception of an object.
Michael, isn't it
the thing, the object.
But isn't it also ultimate truth? Because if I were a Buddha, then
it would not be
ultimate truth
when I looked at it. It has. The Buddha will see its ultimate truth directly, and the Buddha can see it at the same time.
Oh, it has ultimate truth.
Yeah, it is not. This ultimate. Ace, please. Ultimate truth is not being the way you thought it was.
No.
Okay? That's what ultimate truth is. Ultimate truth is, I say again, not being the way you thought it was. That's a negative. Can you see a negative? Can you see the absence of an elephant in this room?
Sure.
Not with your eyeball.
You.
No, you cannot see
the elephant. Was there, I wouldn't see.
I mean, it's a concept. It's abstract. Yeah, it's an abstract. What I'm saying is, emptiness is an abstract. You cannot perceive it the way you perceive a cup. It's a negative. It's an absence of something. And there's a school in Tibetan Buddhism which is pretty strong, which doesn't state that, and it's wrong. And it's very bad.
Doesn't state what?
It's called Janamba. And it's pretty prevalent sometimes. They say somehow emptiness. I mean, even the word emptiness is listed in the Tibetan grammar books as a negative particle, along with not, in. And that's a different story.
So, what is it that they do? The school does?
That's a long story. We'll get there. Year number three. Okay. Then, very interesting, in fact. Okay. Then, Del. Okay. This is the word that they translate as dependent origination. That which occurs through dependence and relation. But I don't want to get into that.
So is it 10 dependent drill origination?
Not like that. And I don't want to get into
that.
Literally. But mainly to dependence. I'm trying to get the relationship in there. Tendel is a way of explaining the deceptive reality of things. This is a way of explaining the deceptive reality, the positive nature that all things have. Tendel, dependent origination, is a way to explain the deceptive reality that all things have.
Now, are you? I'm sort of getting an implication here that this is positive.
Yeah, this
aspect
is the positive
of
aspect.
Negative.
It is deceptive. Stated negatively, what? I just stated it positively. It's deceptive. Now you just stated negatively.
It's not
what you thought.
What you thought.
Okay. That's it. That's all. The first thing is dependent origination. The second thing is
affirmation.
Emptiness. Not what you thought. It's emptiness. Positively stated, it's deceptive. It's dependent, and they're the same thing. See why?
So you're saying the first and second two depend on each other.
No, no.
Oh.
This refers to truth number one. This is how truth number one works. Truth number one and dependent origination are the same thing. That's why it's not so bad to call it dimensional truth or dependent truth. Dependent origination is very famous in Buddhism. Okay? It's one of the most famous ideas in Buddhism. There are sutras called dependent origination. There are sutras where all the Buddha says is, there's a long introduction. You know, the Buddha came, he sat down, he folded his arms, he put his leg, he raised his robe, everyone bowed down, everyone sat down, and they asked him a question. What is dependent origination? He says, if this comes, that occurs. If that comes, this occurs. Thank you. Goodbye. I mean, there's a sutra that doesn't consist of anything more than that. He says, if this happens, that will happen. If this occurs, it will trigger that. Dependent origination, bye. That's all I'm right. Now we explain it. Okay, now I explain it. Dependent origination. What does it mean when he says, if this happens, that happens? The lowest way to explain it is cause and effect. Okay? the lower schools explain it as meaning cause and effect. The lowest three schools. Okay? How many schools are there? When we say school, by the way, don't think I'm talking about the four traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. You know, Nyingma, Sakya, Gelugpa, Kagyupa. Those not. When I'm talking about school, I'm not talking about the four traditions that have existed in Tibet for a mere 1,200 years or so. I'm talking about the four schools that started in India with Nagarjuna back in 200 AD, okay? I'm talking 1,700 years. I'm talking about the four great schools of India. They are roughly the lowest school. I'll use this word, Abhidharma.
I always assumed that those four schools corresponded to the four lineages.
Not at all. No connection at all. It's just people get confused.
Yeah. How do you correspond? Can you mention other words for them? So some of us may be.
Vaibhashika. Chiramo.
Chitamara.
No, that doesn't. Vaibhashika means those who talk about different things. And it comes from a book that they used to study called the Vedic. That's what the Vash means. Vash means, well, long story. Okay. Basically, you can think of them as Abhidharma. They follow the Abhidharma. We follow the Abhidharma too, but that's their main school. Second school is, I'll call it the logic school. Okay? I'll call it the logic school, just for simplicity. Okay? The real word is Satrantika. Now, to understand the name of the second school in Sanskrit, which you don't have to worry about, I'm just doing it for her. They believe in sutra, as we all do.
So it's often called the sutra school?
Yeah.
Okay.
I call
that's
it sutra
all
sutra.
I want to know.
But in Sanskrit, when you make an adjective, the u changes to al. So it's Satrantika.
Okay.
And that's a good way to remember it, because a lot of people mix it up with the Satrantika, which comes later. Saltrantika. It's called vritti in Sanskrit when you strengthen a vowel. Saltrantika. You don't have to worry about it. I'll call it logic school. These two schools are, anybody can guess? Kylie?
Hinayana.
School number three.
Chittamatra.
Yeah, mind only. Chittamatra. Also called Yogacara.
Those are two different
terms. Two words from the same school. Although that same word can be used to apply to certain lower satantika. And I won't get into it. Okay. School number three. School number four.
Madhyamika or Madhyamika?
Madhyamika.
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 And then
Madhyamika.
You have the two divisions in the middle,
right? Yeah, we'll get here.
That's why I said
Yeah. Madhyamika. This is an H, okay? Sorry. Madhyam means middle. It came into Latin and it came into English as medium. Middle itself comes from Madhyam. Most English comes ultimately from Sanskrit. And it's fun to study. A lot of fun to study all the Sanskrit roots of English. We can do that someday if you want. I'd like to revive debating in Sanskrit.
You'd be a very popular guy.
Yeah.
I know.
We know.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, I'll tell you something. The Tibetans are closer to the correct pronunciation than modern scholars.
Of Sanskrit?
Yeah.
How do you know?
People make fun of. I mean, I have my Sanskrit professor was the most brilliant. He was taught by Edgerton, who was taught by Whitney, who wrote all the books. And he said, it's not Raja, it's Rajan. And he showed us why in poetry it had to be that way and how he had figured it out. And he didn't even know that the Tibetans pronounced it Raja. You know? The Tibetans have a J, why did they choose the Z? Why didn't they choose the J? They have a J. Why didn't they say Raja? Because it's not Raja. And even in India now, they don't say Raja. They say Raja.
Isn't that like when they say Raja and Benza?
Yeah, they're correct.
Benza.
Yeah, we don't know how Sanskrit was pronounced 1,200 years ago in Bengal. I mean, it could be the Tibetans are just pronouncing it perfectly according to what... You know, I mean, 100 years from now, some scholar could say, Dendel is all wrong, it's Raten Mborel. And then he would be wrong, but he wouldn't know. And that's another subject. Okay. So anyway.
Two, one.
Yeah. Svatantrika. Svatantrika. A lot of people mix this up with sound chanting. And our teacher pronounces them both pretty much the same way. Svatantrika. The tantra here doesn't have anything to do with the secret teachings of the Buddha. It has nothing to do with tantra. It's a separate meaning of the Buddha. It refers to a special kind of reasoning that they believe in. And you don't need to get into it. You must study it. It refers to a kind of logical statement that they use. By the way, this is not... Well, it's on your homework in a way. I almost said it wasn't on your homework.
What does Abhidharma refer to?
They study a category of literature called Abhidharma. And Abhidharma means knowledge.
Knowledge, okay.
It means knowledge. By Bhashita. But Abhidharma, if you want to know what it means knowledge. Chumama. Do the other schools believe in knowledge too? Of course. Do the other schools believe in logic too? Of course. That's just the name of the school. Okay.
Sanghika is the middle way.
Yeah, because Sanghika is the highest. Yeah, it's called consequence, or I'd like to call it implication. When I said to Kylie, oh, then I guess fake reality is true, huh? If he had said, which he didn't say clearly, he had said, truth is what you divide into the two truths. And I say, oh, so I guess deceptive truth is true, right? Just that sarcasm is a prasangika. That's what a prasangika is. It's a form of logic. It's a sarcastic rejoinder. Oh.
Really?
If he says the sky is, if he says everything in the world is blue, and I say, oh, I guess orange is an orange, not blue. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a prasangika. That's a tenure. Why are they called that? Because they believe that if he says to me, oh, things aren't empty, and all I have to say to him is, oh, and I guess they don't depend on anything, huh? I'll repeat it. If he says to me, things aren't empty, and I said, oh, then I guess they're not dependent on anything now. Suppose, according to the prasangika, he can perceive emptiness on just that statement. I don't have to sit there and say, no, no, things are empty. Look, they have to be dependent, you know.
This is sarcasm. You have to go through all this polite foot shuffling.
Yeah, according to the prasangika,
it's
possible to generate in the opponent's mind
the
perception of emptiness through a prasangika statement, through a sarcastic rejoinder.
So you're saying the tone and the attitude is part of the ego's logic and a debate?
Oh, sure.
Really?
There's eight forms of logical statements, and not so much a sarcasm, but a ridiculous implication of your position, which if you thought about it for 20 seconds, you'd realize. When I say, oh, then I guess nothing depends on anything else. They're not empty, right? And they say, oh, yes, it depends on something that's empty.
It's very intimidating.
Are you adding the sarcasm into it, or does it mean something else? Like
I just explained it. It doesn't mean sarcasm per se. It means a ridiculous implication of your position. And once I point out to you the ridiculousness of it, you will change. And that's just a form of logic. It's just
you're
a form
taking
of
it to its logical extreme.
Right. It's logical,
absurd
conclusion. Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's just something you can mean. It's not a very important point. I mean, that's not that their whole schools hinge on this. It's just why they are named what they are named. It's nice to know why they are called what. It's not a big thing that people spend years about.
It doesn't mean that you just have a particular attitude of your own that you're conveying here.
No, it's very accepted since the beginnings of Buddhism. This is the way we learn. And if I could get you out of books and into debating, you would learn 10 times faster. And we'll get there. You'll never forget what you hear in a debate. You never forget what you screwed up in front of 1,000 monks. I can tell you all the ones I've done. I can tell you all the debates where the guy made a flow. It works. Okay, now, these three schools. Did you leave enough room on your paper? Oh, by the way, these two are... All these are Mahayana.
Sweet.
remember Jeffrey Hopkins explaining this to us in 1973 or something.
What?
Jeffrey Hopkins came to the library when I was a beginning student. You know, and he went through this in about 10 minutes ago.
I have an Alexander version of an
Good. All right, those two schools, I mean, these two halves of the fourth school and the third school are both Mahayana.
How's it Mahayana and Hinayana in the third school? How's it both schools, the third one, Mahayana?
It's going to be...
No, these two are Hinayana.
Oh, the way you draw
and
that
these two, around. Yeah, and this is just... These are going to be position number one about... Think of this as group number one. These are schools, now I'm talking groups. Group number one has three schools in it. Those three schools all are one big group.
But no name.
The lower school.
She asked for it. She asked for it. I wasn't going to give it to you. No, you have to know this, by the way. Now I ask you a question. How many things in the world have a function? Everything does something. It's a synonym for thing almost. Except for certain objects like space. Space don't do nothing. Space just sits there. Place is just there.
You could say it provides a framework.
I could argue about that.
It's beautiful. There's that debate in the Abhidhamma. Okay? It's in the first... You hit it right on the head. Somebody says that in the Abhidhamma question. It's one of the bitterest debates in the Abhidhamma. Of course, space does something. Where do you think this thing is sitting? Space is giving it a place to be. Functionalists are these three schools, and what they believe, and they're called functionalists for a certain reason, and I'm not going to go into it. I'm not going to go into it. That's too much to digest for you. That's not the point tonight. Anyway, those three schools believe, okay, why they're called functionalists? They believe that anything in the world which performs a function truly exists. Anything in the world that does something truly exists. And they're wrong. But that's why they're called functionalists, okay?
What the meaning of?
They think function means something that does something. Like this pen functions to write.
Yes.
And nurses function to help people who are physically handicapped.
Uh-huh.
My function is a great joke.
Yeah, okay.
And these people believe that if something does something, uh-huh. if something works to do something, it really exists. It truly exists.
So what according to them?
But... each one has a different idea.
Oh. How about have inherent existence?
What is the meaning?
No, it's different. The word truly, definite, by definition, inherently, they all have different, grossly different meanings in different schools. And that's a big study. You have to mind it.
What do you mean truly exists?
Later. What does it mean, truly exist? Does this truly exist?
Truly exists? No.
Of course it truly exists.
It exists?
Yeah, truly. It's truly here. Mm-hmm.
So you mean how it look and what it
is? That's a different story. Yeah, yeah. Okay. But according to them, these things truly exist. If it works, it truly exists. But that's not what I want to talk about. I didn't want to talk about
it. In the book here, it's hard to understand what they say in the book.
We'll get there. We're getting there. Hang on. Okay. They're functionalists. Those two schools. Why did I talk about this school? Why did I even bring up this first group? Group number one says that dependent origination means things depend on their causes. Things depend on their causes. Group number one, all say things depend on their causes, and that's what dependent origination means.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. I mean, talk about the pen. is it dependently originating? Is it dependent?
Yeah, but...
Why? Now, suppose you're a functionalist, and suppose I say, okay, I come up and ask you, pen generation, dependent, is a pen dependent?
Yeah.
Does the pen depend on something?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. On what?
On the materials that it's made
out
of.
Yeah, fine. Or more according to them.
On what it does.
On the factory that made it.
On the person who conceived it.
On the person who designed it. The things that came before. Be careful about products, okay? They're not causes. On the things that came before it, that brought the factory, the water, the coloring, the plastic, people who designed it, people who sold it, whatever. It depends on its causes. According to them, that is the dependence of this pen. According to them, then, what would its emptiness be? What's a negative way of saying it depends on its causes?
If it weren't for those causes, it wouldn't come into being.
It don't just happen by itself. It doesn't just happen by itself. According to them, that's the kind of emptiness. That's its emptiness.
But not the parts, though.
We're getting there. Okay? But if I say, look, this pen just didn't come here by itself. It didn't just happen by itself. There are causes. So when I say it didn't come here by itself, that's its emptiness.
That's why.
It's emptiness. According to them. And when I say, look, it had causes, that's its dependence. It's the expression of its deceptive reality. That's its positive nature. It came from something positive, dependent originist.
Are you one of its causes, like?
It didn't come from nothing. Well, when you get into causes, there's five kinds. And it's a long story. Chapter 2, I'll be done. Okay?
Fifth.
I am, in the sense, according to the Abhidharma, because I'm not defending its continued existence. Oh, the kingdom, they have a cute thing in the Abhidharma. It says, the goddamn government is helping me if it's just leaving me alone.
So is this position wrong? The functionalism said, constant causes, henceforth is empty? Is the real position of
it
Buddhism?
It is a position of Buddhism.
Yeah.
It is a position of a Buddhist school, of actually three Buddhist schools. Is it correct? Partially.
We're talking about different definitions of dependent
origination. Yeah. And the way Pavolka describes them in the Tibetan, he says, here's the position of the first three schools. Here's the position of the first Madhyamika school, which is a little better than the first one.
Yeah.
That implies that the first one's not too hard. And then when he gets to Prasangika, he says, and this one is even more subtle, which implies that the first two are not wrong, just less subtle. So in the Tibetan, he's very subtle about it. Okay. Anyway, in general, don't ever think of yourself as denying the lower schools. They are, Hinayana, for example, it's a building block on which we grow. You know, if you could reach Hinayana motivation, God bless. You know, it's like a million light years away from us. You know, true renunciation. If we had that, you know, thanks. If I could be an Abhidharmist, I'd be quite happy. Okay. Group number two, and then we'll take a break. Group number two is
right here.
Group number two has how many schools in it? It's a trick question.
One.
And
half.
Half. Who said half?
I did.
Good. I asked that in the other class. It took about 10 minutes to figure it out. Okay. It's half a school.
So what's
half of the middle way school is group number two. Mm. In the book, I call them the independents.
So you say that the psychiatrics are part of group one?
No, they're not. No. That's where the line stops. Here's group one. First three schools are group one. And group two only consists of half a school. Yeah, the lower half of the last school. The lower half of the four schools is group number two. For purposes of what?
Dependent origination.
Explaining how people explain dependent origination. They say group number two, which is who?
That's
the independent part of the middle way school, the independent section of the middle way school, they say, you lower three schools, you got it wrong. Okay? If you say something is dependent because it comes from its causes, then how do you establish the dependence of emptiness? How do you establish the dependence of space? Things which have no causes. Do you say they don't exist? Do you say they don't depend? Do you say they don't have their own deceptive reality? Which we all say they have to have, right?
So then they say, well, what about things with no causes?
Right, right, right.
And what are things with no causes?
I just gave you the only two I can really think of.
Which is a great lesson.
They're very, in the Abhidharma, in the first chapter, it says, look, if you want the things with causes, look around you, everything. If you want the things without causes, you're going to have to sit down and meditate for a long time to find the only two or three or four that there are. Okay. I'll give you a clue. I mean, things without causes exist. They exist. They are negatives. They are all negatives. The fact that New York is not Chicago is permanent. The fact that New York is not Chicago is an uncaused thing.
But the fact that New York is not New York.
Is this the same category of things that are changing and not changing?
Yes, you can say that too. The fact that New York is not Chicago will never change, it will never vary. Will it end? Yes. Is permanent and impermanent a very good English word? No, I don't think so. But it's too late to change.
Is that what it's usually?
Yeah, I usually translate.
Oh, changing and unchanging.
I used to have bitter debates. I gave it up. It's all, you're not going to change that in the book.
So it's book number two. It's
when Chicago and New York end, the fact that New York is not Chicago will end. But the fact that New York is not Chicago is what the transit is from. It is unchanging. It never varies up to the moment that it stops existing. Alright, so group number two says, we have a better way to explain dependence.
So things without causes are permanent.
Right, same thing. So, group number two says to group number one, the way to explain dependence is, John, now you get your chance. What do you guess?
It's dependent upon their parts.
Yeah, dependence means everything depends on its parts. Dependence means things exist because they depend on their parts.
So what are they saying? They're saying that things that are permanent and unchanging don't have any parts?
Oh, no, they say they do have parts. According to them, now I have people have trouble when they get to this point, but space has parts, emptiness has parts, all things have parts. Yeah, space, according to the Buddhist scriptures, has parts because it consists of the four directions. You can divide space into four directions.
Now, is that something that all the schools believe, or just the Svetlana
school? All schools believe that space has parts, yes.
And that emptiness has parts?
Sure. I don't think so. In fact, the lower schools don't even use the word emptiness. They use no self. And you'll get into it. The big difference is between all these things, and you don't know them yet, and you take a long time to know them. Okay. So, they say that things exist because they depend, kind of.
The second school says things exist because they depend on their parts.
And what does the first group say? Things exist because
they have a function.
No. Because they depend on the cause.
No, sorry.
Things exist because they depend on the cause, according to the first group. Second group, things exist because they depend on nitya.
They depend on their parts.
On their parts.
If you say they exist because they depend on their parts, or
through depending on their cause. By way of depending on their cause. You can say because. And group number three will do after the break. Because you need
a break.
A fresh mind for that one. That's the highest one. And that's a little hard.
Michael,
yes,
do you have any correlation between the Hinayana and Mahayana? Is there also, so you worked on the philosophical school from Hinayana and Mahayana. Is there a corresponding correlation between the motivation of the Hinayanas and the motivation of the Mahayanas? It depends on that philosophy.
Partly. Like, according to them, the distinctions between Hinayana and Mahayana, depend on how you perceive emptiness. And what do you perceive? And according to them, that's all wrong.
Wrong.
Wow.
Wow.
This is the third group's position. Who is the third group? Yeah, the higher part of the last school. The higher part of the middle way school. Okay? This group here. We call them implication in your homework. Oops, I let it out. The implication school. Implication means, oh, are you telling me oranges are blue? And that's an implication of him saying everything is blue. Consequence is a good translation. I like it also. Not bad.
Another name is consequence.
Yeah, this is all right. You can use this.
So with the Svatrika, is that called the independent school? Is that the name of that school?
Yeah. So attention. Okay. Mingbei Satsam. Sam means just. Just. Sak means labeled. Ming means with a name. And a thought.
That's what Ming
Zen means? That's what the Ming means. You can divide it like that.
What does Zen mean?
And a thought. Okay. This, according to the high school, things exist because they depend on you calling them what they are. They depend on you thinking of them as what they are. Let's put it into one sentence. They exist because they depend on you calling them and thinking of them as you do. They don't exist. What's their negative nature compared? They don't exist. What's their emptiness, really?
Their emptiness is their lack of a
good
name or a
good
label.
Their lack of existing without a name.
Ancient labeling theory.
Yeah, they do not exist outside of your mind. You're calling them what you do. You are thinking of them as well. That's their...
You're saying things do not exist outside of your mind? So
outside of the way you think of them.
But outside of your mind would be more like the mind.
Right. Well, not even the mind wants to think that. That's another subject. Okay.
So your thought is the thing as opposed to some independently existing entity out there.
We'll talk about it.
Thinking of them as you being the key phrase.
Yeah. What it means is this. When you perceive a pen, okay, you are perceiving a long, red, roundish thing. Okay? You are perceiving a red, long, roundish thing. Alright? When you are concentrating on the length of it, the longness of it, you cannot be perceiving the pen. You're focused on something long. You're focused on longness. When you perceive the redness, you can't perceive the pen. It's impossible. When you perceive the pen, you cannot see its length. You cannot be concentrating on a single unit of it, a single part of it. It's impossible that you are seeing this pen.
Abstraction based on your perception of...
You are seeing some red, you are seeing some long, you are seeing some round. In fact, you're not even seeing all of it. You can't see it behind here. You can't see the back. If I told you the back
is
green...
It's an inference based on your
seeing
perception of aspects. Of
you're seeing a few parts, you're seeing a few clues, and you make a mental perfect pen, and you call that 10. and your whole life, you think there's this perfect thing out there. There's not. You're seeing parts, and mentally you're unifying them and calling them pen. But it can't exist that way. There can't be a pen.
This
like
is
this.
The idealism of Plato.
Very similar, and Jung and all. Okay, I mean very similar. You are perceiving not a pen. You are perceiving your mental perfect image of a pen. You can't be perceiving a pen. And that argument is difficult. Okay? If you're looking at the length, you can't be perceiving the pen. If you don't look at the length, you can't see the pen. If you're looking at the pen, you can't be seeing the length. It's impossible what you're doing. Why? What's really going on, you're seeing in mental image. You don't know that there's a back here. You don't know that this dark doesn't go on for infinity. You don't know that this is the rounded front of a thin wall. It goes. You make assumptions.
So is there an argument that takes place that says, well, you can't perceive its length and its penness, if you will, at the same time?
No, you cannot, right.
So, therefore, since you must perceive its length
to perceive
its in order to perceive its being, then you can't be perceiving its penness.
Yeah, when you see its length. What you're doing is an impossibility. That's one of the proofs for it. We'll get on. Yeah.
Well, aren't you doing something else at the same time? Aren't you segregating parts? Because we also see a hand that's holding up the rounds and so forth.
Yeah.
So we're taking all the parts that we consider not to be the pen, putting them on one side, taking all the parts that we consider to be the pen, putting them on the other, and then making assumptions based
this
on
this is
that.
A thing called Shinsel. Called the Apoha Theory, and it's one of the greatest teachings of Buddhism, and Western philosophers are crazy about it, and you study that in the Paramahansa. And what you just described, it's a long story. It comes
say
in
it
the fourth year. No, it's a long story. It's not appropriate here. The way in which you make the mental image is very closely tied to what you just said, and it's a beautiful subject, and it's deep. You know, you debate it for 14, 15 hours a day, 1 month out of the year, and we have never reached the second chapter yet. It's an incredible book.
That's always jumping around because the same object then becomes part of a desk set as well.
Long story. That whole thing is very deep and very interesting, and we'll spend a lot of time on it if we get that far. 50-year probably. So you can't see. The pen can't be as you think it is. The pen is really Mingde Shaksan.
So this position is more refined than the other two that I was saying.
Yeah, in fact, that's exactly the way Chapter Pabokan refers to it. He says, this idea of what dependent origination means is the most subtle. And it is the correct one. I mean, this is the one that Nagarjuna had. This is the position of Shakyamuni Buddha. Okay, that's good enough. But Shakyamuni Buddha is what? Which of the four?
All?
He taught all four, but what is he?
Adyamika.
He's a prasangika, please. Anyone who perceives emptiness is automatically a prasangika.
According to the
prasangika. So it's true. It's also true. It happens to be true.
It happens to be true, spoken by a true...
I thought he was just labeled with
a lot of thought. So, Michael, this idea of what you mentioned, of when you see the penness of it, you're not seeing its parts. When you're seeing its parts, you're not seeing its penness.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I want to talk one more thing, and I'm sorry to interrupt it. But there will come a day in your Dharma practice, if you study well, and if you meditate daily, that you'll be standing at a stove, for example, and you'll be looking at the pot, and you just got through studying some Buddhist perception theory, and you're staring at the pot, and you will see directly, you will see with absolute clearness that you're not looking at a pot, that you are looking at your mental image of a pot, that there is no pot out there, that you are looking at a mental image. Your mind is focused on itself, in a sense, and not on the pot out there. On that day, you have, for the first time, understood deceptive reality. Directly. You live in deceptive reality. Everything you see is deceptive reality. On that day, for the first time, you understood its nature. That comes a few hours before you perceive emptiness directly.
It's like the whole world starts swirling.
And things start popping. Things start booming.
See, when you see an object I would say that beyond the conventions that you
learn. You perceive that it is your convention.
For the
first time you see directly that it is only your name and your mental image of a few parts, put on a few parts. And at that moment you have achieved the highest levels of the second path, of the five paths, Dorlam, Chichong. And then you go to your room, or you go to a temple, you sit down, you enter deep meditation, and you see emptiness directly. That's what happens. And the whole process is called heat. You know, the levels are called the four levels are, you know, you start to get hot. You know, your mind starts to pop. Because this is the first time you've ever seen what deceptive reality is. And then suddenly, maybe in a half hour later, you perceive emptiness directly. That has to be done sitting down deep meditation. And then you are, when you come out, you see Buddhas. You see how many future lives you have to go. 7, for example. You see your past lives directly. You see all these objects. And from that moment on, you can't doubt anything anymore. In fact, the thing that you give up permanently when you see emptiness directly is doubt about Buddhism. You will never doubt it again. And it doesn't matter what anybody tells you in your whole life after that, because you saw Buddha directly. You also have one side realization that you're not crazy, and you're not hallucinating, and that this is reality. Right? It's an unbelievable. And then you have nothing to, you have no normal fears or worries after that. And you can't do certain bad deeds after that. For example, you can't commit sexual misconduct after that, adultery. There's certain things that you cannot do.
You're not able, or you're not allowed? Or?
No, you can't. You will never. Because of your realization. You see the Buddha. So people come and debate with you, Christianity, Judaism, blah, blah, blah. I have seen a Buddha directly. Don't tell me about it. Future lives, I saw my future lives. I know I have 7 lives today. And I know I will be a Buddha. And they won't call him Michael. You know? So don't tell me. I don't care. You know, you can tell me anything. I don't have this doubt anymore. I don't have this. Okay. Derek.
So, back to my question. Skipped over there.
One more point, okay? What was your question?
You're right. You said that when you perceive the penness, you cannot perceive the parts. When you perceive the parts, you cannot perceive the penness.
The pen.
Yeah. So is that saying that you have to be a Buddha to perceive both the truths simultaneously?
No, not that.
That's not what you're saying.
It's a different thing. What I'm trying to say is, if you analyze how you think you see something, it's impossible.
What's impossible?
So what you think you're doing. It's impossible. You can't be doing what you think you're doing. You can't be seeing a pen.
Because you're not seeing its penness.
If you saw a pen, yeah. You couldn't see pen's length. Yeah. If you're focusing on pen's length, you can't see pen. It's an impossibility what you are doing.
Yeah,
what you think you're doing is impossible.
So you're not perceiving its entirety.
You're not seeing a pen.
It's the bottom line. You're not
seeing a few parts. By the way, something very important. The parts, the roundness, the redness, the longness, the fact that you saw me writing with it, those data, those clues, they give you clues. And you call them pen. Fine. It's correct. It's a correct perception. It's a valid perception. It's reasonable. And Madhyamika says that. Madhyamika says, when you call a long, red, round writing thing a pen, so God bless, that's fine. You're right. It's the right label. Things are labeled, but things are labeled reasonably.
As long as you know that you're merely calling it that and that it isn't that.
No, but even before you realize that, obviously you can pick up a pen and use it. It works. Madhyamika says, I told people, remember that classic moment in Woodstock? Everyone's of that age, right? That farmer guy gets up. I'm Max Yazda, and I'm a farmer. And everybody goes, "Ah!" The guy actually has the same line. He says, "Whatever Joe Schmo farmer believes, I believe." He says that. He says, "I believe you can go take a seed, put it in the ground, cover it, water, and a thing will come up, and you know, you can eat it." I'm Madhyamika believes that. Everything works. how it works, it looks to be a certain way, you name it a certain way, it's fine. Laura exists. The self of Laura exists. Which brings me to the next sentence.
So
yes? Go ahead.
Just to wrap up my point, so is your ultimate point then that proof that we can't see both of those things, that's proof that we're not perceiving it correctly? Is that
right,
the bottom line?
Right, right. That you are doing something, if you think about what you think you're doing, it's impossible.
Okay.
And there's many other proofs. You know, there's dozens of proofs.
Maybe it seems more refined, this third approach, because you can always imply some naming process in the other two groups, but you are talking
right.
about causes or,
yeah.
or
yeah.
starts.
Yeah. Not bad. Okay. Dark means self. Dark means self. Who can I pick on? Who can talk about? Okay, Doc. You gotta yell at me. It's just been very quiet. Doc may be itch. The doc doesn't exist. Doc may be itch.
True.
Huh? Faith now. Faith doesn't exist, right? No. So I guess faith herself doesn't exist. Meata. Faith meata.
Faith exists in the realm of reality.
Faith yata. So faith exists.
Faith exists in one half of the two different kinds of existence.
Does faith herself exist or not?
Faith exists in one way.
Faith herself exists.
Except reality, faith exists.
Faith herself?
Perception.
Does herself exist?
Notion of faith.
Just say yes or no. Faith herself exists. By the way, when you take your pre Geshe exams and your Geshe exams, you're not allowed to say anything but yes or no.
You're not allowed to say yes or no.
But yes or no. And you can defeat the other person by an intelligent yes. He can be screaming and yelling for 2 hours, and just by giving the right yes or no, like computers, they're binary, we come to the truth. Faith herself exists or not? Right, she does, right? So Buddhism teaches that self exists, right? Dark is the non-existent thing. It's the ultimate non-existent thing, okay? Dark. Don't exist. Self, don't exist. That's every Buddhist school believes that. There is no Buddhist school that believes that the self exists.
Oh, you mean the farmers who say people don't exist?
Self, yeah. I didn't say that.
What you mean.
I didn't say that.
I'm a farmer. Nobody exists.
I didn't say that. Come on, debate.
Oh, Nagarjuna said it.
I didn't say that. I accept Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna didn't say that. He didn't say farmers don't exist. What are you talking about?
Yes or no?
No. Nagarjuna didn't say that.
Nagarjuna didn't say
that. Nagarjuna said farmers exist.
Yes.
Farmers right. themselves exist.
Right.
Self and the farmer exist.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's all. He doesn't accept
pardon me?
He doesn't believe self exists. Okay. You're close to beating me. A few more words, I really got sick. Okay, Doc. Now, obviously, there's a self which exists.
Of course it exists.
Okay, obviously it exists. I mean, Fran exists, Tom exists, faith exists. Okay, the idea of self, meaning a person, Buddhism has no trouble with. That we are not fighting against self. That's not what self means. Atman. Not with something. You
ego.
Ever think that?
Not the ego.
It doesn't mean ego has nothing to do with ego, has nothing to do with person. The doc that we deny, by the way, and the word doc refers to all objects. Okay? We deny the doc of a table. We deny the doc of a wall. In other words, the word that people translate as self, we can refer to things too, not just people. The table itself.
Well,
as
in by itself.
Yeah. Okay? We are denying, but so self, the self that we're talking about, and you have to remember that, is a non-existent thing. It don't exist. It's not the Liana that exists. She herself exists. We believe that. That's not what we mean by self. What do we deny?
I think it's much easier if you think of self as self-nature. Or just nature. What we deny is that anything has a nature of its own. I prefer the word blank. I like the word blank. I love the word blank. I've never seen it in a book, but I like it. Things are blank. They do not have any nature of their own. Things are there, but they are blank. You supply the nature.
That makes it sound like they're identityless.
They are. I'm trying to say that. They are. They are. House is not a house. It's how you make it.
Well, they have their identities are as many as there are people perceiving them.
Ah, that's okay. But it's not their own. Yeah, when Buddhism says no self, this is what we mean. Forget everything you ever heard before. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with ego, nothing to do with pride, nothing to do with self-identity, nothing to do with person. It's all wrong.
Exists from its own side, right?
Well, each school has a different flavor of what God means.
Well, according to that...
You now tell me. You tell me now. According to the first group. Okay, pretend you're an Abhidhamma. What's no self? What is it? This is how you have to say it in a debate ground. If the self existed, if a self existed, I can't say what's the self like, right? Because it doesn't even exist. It's a no-no. It's a boo-boo in debate ground to say, oh, what's the self like? That's like saying, you know, what's a rabbit that's 20,000 feet high and pink like? You know, it just doesn't exist. Okay? So I have to say it this way. Ariel, if the self existed, and if you were an Abhidharma, what would it be like?
It would have a function.
No, no, no. That's
not the nature of cause.
It would not have dependent originations, which would mean what? It would come
from its own side.
It would occur
because of causes.
Without, how many could that be? Without any cause.
Say that again.
According to an Abhidharma, one way of explaining self would be, say, anything that could happen without any causes. Just came by itself. This is what science took, you know, a couple centuries to overcome, this stupid idea, you know. Find the reasons for things, okay? Find what causes things. I know. Things don't just happen by themselves. If you're an Abhidharma and I say, what would the self be like if it existed? You say, well, it would be a tree that grew without a seed, without water, without earth, without anyone to tend it, without sunlight. That would be a self tree.
No, but before you said that, in the first group they say that things exist when they have causes, not the reverse. Like, now you're saying the reverse.
Yeah, because I'm saying, what are they denying? What do they say doesn't exist? Doc is a synonym for Tom Carley's favorite thing.
Faith?
No.
My favorite self is self.
And that's the last thing you have to know tonight, okay? I'm sorry, the class was long, but as you see, it takes a little time to explain. So, gotcha.
Gotcha.
Literally, what we deny. What we Buddhists deny. Another way you could say, a self-existent thing.
How does that break down?
Michael,
Gak means deny.
If
Ja means what we.
According to the third group, right? If you use a name.
Wait, I'll debate you on the third group. Hang on just a second. Okay. Ujira. The second group says, I'll give you a clue, okay? The second group says that things exist because they have parts. Okay? Because they depend on their parts. Now tell me, what's the self? What's the self? What does Buddha say is not true? Not true.
No self. So nothing exists.
It doesn't exist. A thing which exists without parts doesn't exist. Okay, so that's the dark according to these people. Anything which can exist without its parts, without depending on the parts. Is it possible that a thing exists without its parts? Impossible. So they say, dark means anything which could exist without parts. It's impossible. We say no dark. Dark doesn't exist.
Is that what gacha is?
Gacha means the thing that the Buddhists are denying.
So that's what they're denying, it exists.
I can give you
parts.
Another word for it. Self-existent thing. Self-existent thing. Gacha.
Self-existent.
Self-existent thing. Now, this was Nitya's question. Now we got there, okay? If I'm in the third school, third group, if I belong to the highest school of you belong, and I'm asking you a question, okay? If the dark existed, if Atman really did exist, which it doesn't, right? What would it be like? According to
it
you
would
guys.
Be something that has a name, so it exists.
No, something that exists without.
Something in the third group would exist when they have a name.
Yeah, so if I'm asking you, describe to me something that doesn't exist.
Oh, something that doesn't have a name.
Right.
But self is
anything that could exist without depending on my thinking about it a certain way. Anything that could exist without me giving it a name, that's what that is, according to the highest school. Okay. Laura Siegel, it doesn't depend on my perceptions. That Laura Siegel is God. That Laura Siegel is Gacha. Any Laura Siegel that could exist without my perceptions of her, making her who she is for me, is a dog. That's the dog. Does it exist? Does my imagination of it exist? Yes.
And that's the inherent.
And I grab onto it, and I hold onto it, and it causes all my suffering. Why?
So you either like it or you don't like it.
Now we have to go back to the definition of reality according to the third group, because they say that everything is real as soon as you give a name and a concept.
No, in a sense. It is real. No, once you give it a name and a thought, it's real.
So now in itself, I will say we have a name and we have also as many concepts as you want. So why is it?
How is it? And I'll ask Kanye. How is it? And I used to wonder about this for years until I found it in a certain scripture. Why is it that if I hold to a Laura Siegel that doesn't depend on my perception, why should that cause all my suffering? Why is it so important to see this? Supposedly, if I understand this idea now, I will no longer have anger, I will no longer have jealousy, I will no longer have desire, I will no longer have any suffering.
Because you're not dependent on fictions, you're not dependent on phantoms. Objects. Your reality is based on that what's real rather than that which isn't real.
Partly that. If she exists outside of my perceptions, then she's really nice, or she's really bad. Then the guy at work is really bad, and I should get angry at him. If it's not just my perception,
so you take responsibility.
If it's not just my perception, but if he's really bad from his own side. Okay, I can have anger. I can have jealousy. If that pretty girl is really pretty from her own side, and not because I kept my morality in the past, I should desire her. But she's not. It's beautiful. Okay, and I'll say it the other way around. Anytime you have one of those emotions, it's focused on the gacha. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting. You cannot have a negative emotion unless you believe the thing is self-existent. You cannot have hatred towards something. You cannot have desire towards something. You can't have jealousy towards something unless you mistake it and think that it exists from its own side.
Would that also be true of positive emotions then?
A positive, harmful emotions, yeah. Like
attachment. No, beneficial emotions. Love, joy.
It's a beautiful question. And the opening lines of the greatest Madhyamika book of all time explain how compassion must ultimately get rid of this idea. Your compassion must become blind to gotcha. Your compassion must focus on what's really there, the John Stillman who's really there, and not the one that I thought was there. And until then, it's not real compassion. That's another story, okay? I'll say it again. Any negative emotion you have is focused on, is based on, believing that that person is bad from his own side, or beautiful from her own side, desirable from her own side, and not because of my past karma.
You mean any emotion that's not neutral?
I mean any emotion which, the definition of a klesha.
Then you can say any impure feeling, and then you knock out the whole thing.
Yeah, let's start with the nyomo. Let's start with the klesha. Let's start with what they call mental afflictions. I love that translation, because klesha means klish, means to disturb you, to upset you. Any thought, what I can say is this, very interesting, very applicable to getting to nirvana in this life, okay? Any thought you have, which is unpleasant, which upsets you, whether it's desire or anger or jealousy,
stirs you up.
Any thought which anxiety that disturbs your mind is focused at
a thing which doesn't even exist.
By definition, if you are understanding its blankness, and if you're understanding who's filling in the blanks, which is your past karma, you cannot be angry. Why? No, because you realize that his ugliness comes from being angry before. It would be schizophrenic to get angry now. It would be insane to get angry now. Why? You look at this angry man and you say, oh, this is because I was angry. He's blank. He's not angry on his own. His wife loves him even when he's yelling at me.
Could you be angry at yourself?
Oh, sure.
Could you both be angry at the same time?
Yes, you can. So for me to be angry at him, once I understand his blankness, I understand his fullness, his dependence. He exists because I'm labeling that. Where did that labeling come from? Mental tendency. Where did the tendency come from? It was planted by a past bad feeling. It's planted by my own.
What about, Michael, if you feel that someone attacks you with anger and you know that you are blank for him as he is blank for you, and so you get angry because you see no reason for him to attack you because he's his own karma? So
then you didn't understand what I just said. And you're not following what I just said. He's blank, he's angry, and he's attacking you. He appears to be angry, he appears to be attacking you. Why? How can you even see it? Why do you fill in the color that way? It's a sketch. You're filling in the color. Why did you choose that color? Who made you choose that color? It's your past karma. And later we'll study the mind-only school. The mind-only school is wonderful for this reason. They explain clearly and precisely how the perception of me being angry at someone in the past plants the perception of someone being angry at me in the future.
Who may, by the way, also be having the perception of himself being angry.
Oh, sure, he does. No, very well, he could. Now, one more. And then I say, I want to leave you with that, and I don't want to say anything else tonight. I just gave you the key to nirvana. You have it, and that's why you must see emptiness. What will happen if everybody in the world knows this thing?
Everybody deals with their own stuff.
No, yeah, you wouldn't be angry anymore. Because why? If you want to meet this angry man again, what's the best way?
Anger.
Plant yourself an angry seed.
Yeah.
Okay? It's the best way to meet him again. If you want to live in a world which is paradise, stop being angry. That is how emptiness relates to this whole thing. It's not that if you see emptiness today, suddenly the world is nirvana tomorrow. It's not true. It won't happen. Except if you understand emptiness clearly, you will be moral. You will keep your morality. And then, because of keeping your morality, you will live in a paradise later.
And that's where the bliss comes in. That's how everything is bliss.
Sure.
I always wondered how the bliss just, you know, like the nature of everything
no,
is bliss.
It's okay, bliss. I see emptiness tonight. What's the emptiness? Everything going to be nice tomorrow? I still got to be in New York. You know? It's not like that. It never will be like that.
And so the only place the bliss comes from is realizing everything is blank.
Jinbei Longju Chungide, quotation from the Buddha. Wealth comes from giving. Bliss comes from morality.
So
if you want to be surrounded by beautiful girls, don't commit adultery.
So the inheritance
is funny.
So,
yeah, I mean, they won't be ugly. The angels around you won't be ugly.
You
know.
You
so
no, they will, and you'll have the right thought about them too. So be, I better think nice, or else I won't be able to see them. Maybe.
So you're saying the inherent nature of things is not bliss. You just create bliss by your karmic deeds.
Of course.
I thought the inherent nature of everything was bliss and emptiness.
I'm talking about
that's
bliss.
That's
tantric.
No,
bliss.
I'm talking
the method and wisdom.
Yeah, I'm talking about that. But I don't want to go on anymore. Just leave it you with that. That is the road to Nirvana. That's the ticket. That's how it happens. Now, what do you have to do?
Uh-huh.
Tomorrow, when you have either emotion come up, and I'm talking also about, to me, anger and strong desire are less frequent than small anxiety. Worries about my life, you know, am I good enough, am I doing the right thing, you know, am I, you know, these small anxieties are also focused at God's self. To me, they are more sickening and more disturbing to me, and they ruin my happiness more than the rare outbreaks of anger at some kindly
rare.
or desire. Okay? I mean, these are the things that ruin your day, right? So the next time, think, what do you think? Think that the object is empty. And then everything else comes from there. The object is blank. When the guy is screaming at you, he's already saying, just remember, what did they say in class? Think he's blank. Just think he's blank. And the rest will come. The rest meaning what? Oh, he's blank. But he does. He really does seem to be angry. Oh, yes, he is angry because I'm seen as angry. Because if he's blank, he's not angry by himself. I'm seeing that blank thing, that blank white screen, looks like an angry guy because of my own past deeds, my own past anger. Oh, what should I do now? Okay? Do not get angry. Why? Now, I ask you a question. If you follow the practice I just described, will he stop being angry?
No.
No. And you can see that. Right? That's the first thing I have to say. I mean, we're talking cause and effect, and there's always a time gap. Your life will start to get extremely pleasant, but not tomorrow. I tell you the truth, and I know it's the truth. And I tell you one more thing. The practice of not being angry at him immediately starts to make your life pleasant. It's not the karmic result. It's simply that you stopped your own anger for 5 minutes. You know, you prohibited yourself from getting angry through your wisdom. That's by the function of wisdom. That is the function of wisdom. Through your wisdom, you chose not to be angry at this moment. So already, that result comes immediately. Your life will be quite nice. These bad reactions to bad people are not only karmically wrong, they louse up your day also. So what I'm saying is, the karmic results take time to purify. But the anger, which louses up your day, you can stop that tomorrow. And it will stop. It's quite nice.
Just say, like the Dalai Lama said, he said, I don't, you know, wake up in the morning and say, oh, I feel so good, I got angry at somebody today.
Yeah.
So you don't...
You just won't have it.
Yeah.
And it's, what's pleasant is once you use the emptiness method, you don't have to struggle with all these band-aid methods, which are true methods, which are Buddhist methods, but they're not ultimate methods. You know, like, oh, I shouldn't be angry at him because he can't help it. He's under control of his anger. That's a good meditation. That's a Shantideva meditation. It will not bring you nirvana.
So if you're getting upset with yourself with that thing, you're supposed to look at it the same. That's a little harder.
It's harder. It's much harder. As Tom said before, much harder to see the emptiness of Ariel, to Ariel. You have to realize that the Ariel that you are worried about
is an Ariel who's very outable. Very horrible. Because of your mind. Does it make it less painful? No. Does it make it less, you know, do you have less anxiety as of tomorrow? No, I'm sorry, you won't. But if you don't get anxiety, and you don't do the bad deeds like anger, which come from anxiety, you won't have anxiety in the future. And in fact, that's the only way to remove anxiety.
But it also means that you don't stop seeing people who appear to be angry to themselves either, right? I mean, that's still in New York.
Well, every Buddhist scripture and almost every religious book I've ever seen that's worth anything says, just concentrate on yourself. You know, God knows who you are. I don't know who you are. You could all be Buddhist a million years ago. I have no idea. I can't read your mind. I don't know who you are. I know what you look like. That's about all I know. You know, worry about your own.
No,
concentrate on your own.
But the point is the reason we're going through this exercise is to help people who have anger appearing to themselves.
Eventually, but work on.
First,
yeah, really, truly.
No, but I mean, you're not trying to say to everybody, if you see somebody who's angry or appears to be angry at you, that's not valid and that's not true. It's just, yes, that's the way you see them, but they also see it to themselves at the same time. You don't have to buy what they're selling, but they're still trying to sell it, and that's hurting them too. If you're trying to help them,
eventually,
to learn not to sell it.
But as you know, it's your own. What you can affect immediately is yourself. You have no idea why he's appearing angry.
Right, but I'm not saying that see an angry person coming at you and deceive yourself that they're not angry themselves.
That we don't know.
Well, that they don't appear.
We don't even know that. Many bodhisattvas. It's possible for a person to be a great bodhisattva, to choose a life, to choose to live on this planet for a whole life, just to meet Tom Crowley for 5 minutes, pretend to be angry with him.
Right.
It's possible. People are alive who are doing that now. It's possible. Okay. They know they come to a planet to live for 70 years only to meet you for that time and show you anger. Possible. We can't know. Okay, so
not to show you anything, to show you something that appears to be
of course. Okay.
So Michael, on all this, you know, we've got this infinite past of seeds to fix, you know?
Yeah.
So
don't worry about the cleaning must take extraordinary methods. That's why we're talking about bodhicitta.
And it seems so difficult to have an infinite past of stuff to clean.
No, you're doing pretty good right now. To be a human in a Dhamma class, you must have been cruising pretty well.
But I'm talking, we're talking 10, 20, 30 years versus an eons.
That's why you have to use bodhicitta. That's why your good deeds have to be slow. At least try to imagine your bodhicitta when you think about it, that you're towards all living creatures. And also another big method is rejoicing. They say that if you just sit down in your bed before you go to sleep, you say, oh man, I'm so glad Buddha wasn't around. You know, the Dalai Lama, I'm so glad the Dalai Lama is around in the world. That by that simple act of being glad, you collect 10% of his virtue.
You what?
You collect 10% of his virtue.
10% of his virtue?
They say that.
So if you do that 10 times, you got a win.
Sāsī-bhūhī-yam-śe-mē-tā-śāṁ
This is the end of Class 9.